This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Talking as Fast as I Can, from Gilmore Girls to Gilmore Girls and everything in between. This is the author, Lauren Graham. For my mom and dad. Introduction. If you'd asked me back at the beginning of my career to guess which character I was most likely to return to 15 years after I'd played her for the first time, there would have been only one answer. Even back then, I knew from the very first time I read the script that I had been given the opportunity to play someone very special. In fact, if you'd asked me to bet money on this guess, I would have bet every one of my pennies. Because even though I've been lucky enough to play many memorable ladies and have true and deep affection for each and every person I've ever pretended to be, there's really only one with whom I have the most special kind of connection. In acting, as in life, you try to pretend you don't have favorites, but usually you do. And usually everyone else can see it too. I wrote this book because, luckily for me, my favorite was also a character beloved by fans and, in my opinion, represents the time I felt I was at my absolute best as an actor. I think we can all agree I was never better and the audience was never more impressed than when I got the chance to inhabit this popular character. See photo number one. The critics called me, well, I'm not sure we had a theater critic at Langley High School in the late 1980s, but I think it's undisputed that my performance as Dolly Gallagher Levi in Hello, Dolly! Was indeed adored by fans, or, as I like to call them, my grandmother. I believe I'm quoting her verbatim, in fact, when I tell you she raved that my Dolly had an impressive number of costume changes. And, not to brag, but my father also deemed my performance, wow, that hat sure has a lot of feathers. So, I think I pretty much nailed everything there was to nail as an actress back in my junior year of high school, which is why it's baffling that no one has yet called to invite me to reprise that role on Broadway, or even at the obvious next best place, the Langley High School Auditorium. In fact, and I don't mean to sound like a diva here, I'm pretty upset about it. The people, my dad, deserve to see me again years later with, perhaps only slightly less, age makeup crayoned onto my face. Somebody get Ben Brantley on the phone. Watch your back, Carol Channing. I'm coming to get you. But seriously, I really wrote this book because getting to play fast-talking Lorelai Gilmore again made me reflect on what it had been like to play her the first time, and that made me reflect on how I even got there at all and some of the ways my life had changed in between the first and second incarnations. So this book is about the past and also the almost present, since I'll share with you some of the diary I kept while filming Gilmore Girls, A Year in the Life. In this audiobook, I will also see into the future and report my findings to you and to select heads of state. These findings will be lies, as I cannot actually see into the future. But who can stop me saying whatever I want here? It's my audiobook. I'm drunk with power. This audiobook is about growing up, starting out, and the time I was asked to audition with my butt. It's about all the odd jobs I had on the way to pursuing my dream, some of the bad fashion choices I made, and the 11 million diets I've tried. I'll tell you how I learned to be a more efficient writer, how I discovered that I'm a terrible judge, and how I realized that meeting guys at award shows was perhaps not the best way to start a successful relationship. I wondered what it would be like to put someone I loved so much down for 8 years and then pick her up again. I wondered if rebooting Gilmore Girls could be as gratifying as doing the series was the first time, if the show would feel as fresh and quirky and smart and speedy as it had been, if returning to Stars Hollow after all those years would be as wonderful as I'd dreamed it would be. Spoiler alert, it was. Fast forward. Some of the most exciting things that happened in my life took place before I turned 6 years old. I was born in Honolulu, Hawaii, which is awesome right there. But 3 weeks later, before I even had time to work on my tan, we moved to Japan. Japan, the home of my most favorite food ever, mashed peas. Well, that was probably my favorite food back then. What a waste, since I could have been eating spicy tuna rolls with extra wasabi. Damn you, baby Lauren, and your infantile palate. Well, to be fair, you were an infant. Sorry, I yelled. In Tokyo, we lived with my grandmother for a while, and I had a Japanese nanny, or uba, which incidentally translates to milk mother, something I just found out by looking it up, hold please, while I call my therapist. Her name was Sato-san, and I loved her. And as a result, my first word was in Japanese. It was oheso. You might think that's Japanese for mommy or daddy, but no, oheso is Japanese for belly button, which I think already proves I'm a very unusual, deep, and contemplative person, and there's really nothing left to say. Thank you for buying this book. The end. Wait, a few more things. My mother, the daughter of missionaries, had grown up in Japan and spoke fluent Japanese. She was also incredibly smart and beautiful, a combination that led to this. See photo number 2. That's my grandmother holding me while we watch my mother, who is on television. Back when there were just 3 channels in America, and maybe even fewer in Tokyo, and an air of mystery surrounding the whole thing. Not like today, when the statistical probability of not at some point stumbling onto your own reality show is inconceivably low. Television had only recently been invented then, and there she was, actually on it. And I was so little, I was probably just thinking about mashed peas again, or, more likely, my favorite subject, belly buttons. In related news, apparently on some Geeky Woogle type page of mine, I am quoted as saying belly buttons are important, which, while obviously sort of true, medically speaking, taking into account the life-giving properties of the umbilical cord, was also clearly a joke. Yet I can't tell you how many times during an interview a journalist gets that somber, I'm going in for the kill look I love so much, and asks me with knitted brow, faux sincerity, do you really think belly buttons are important? Let me clear the air, once and for all. No, I do not. Although, this book isn't very long yet, and I've already talked about belly buttons quite a bit. Damn you, tabloid journalists, you wise truth uncoverers! Again, sorry, the yelling must stop. So anyway, there she was, my mother, on the largest television available at the time, which was roughly the size of a Rubik's Cube. Also, check out her dope 60s Priscilla Presley look. Her ability to speak the language as a non-native was so unusual at the time that she was asked to appear on a Japanese daytime talk show. My parents weren't together very long. They hadn't known each other well when they decided to get married, and then they had me right away when they were both just 22 years old, and, well, that about sums it up. They were very, very young. At the time, my mom was also trying to pursue a career as a singer, and it was decided I should stay with my dad. They parted as friends, and my father made the obvious next choice, something we'd all probably do in this situation. He moved us to the Virgin Islands, where we lived on a houseboat. I slept in a bunk bed type thing that was also the kitchen. I was picked up for nursery school by the bus, which was actually a motorboat. We moved there because... you know what? I don't remember exactly. Let's call my dad and ask him. He probably won't pick up, because he's on the East Coast, and it's a Saturday in the springtime, so unless it's pouring down rain, he's out playing golf. But I'll give you a visual, just in case, so you too can play Call My Dad at home. See photo number 3. I know, isn't it a shame we look nothing alike? Okay, let's see if he's home. Ring, 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 ring. Nah, I told you, he's probably not.
Hello.
Oh, hi, I didn't think you'd be home.
It's raining here.
Well, then, that explains it. Hey, remind me, why did we live on a houseboat that time?
Who is this?
You have other children you lived on a houseboat with?
No, I have other children who call me more.
Dad, please, I call you all the time. So, this is for the book, and...
is this going to be another befuddled father character like in your last book?
Dad, I wouldn't call that character befuddled in general. He's just a little befuddled by technology.
Wait, what did you say? I couldn't hear you. I just hit one of these dumb phone buttons wrong.
Yeah. I was just saying that the father character in my first novel, the New York Times bestseller, Someday, Someday, Maybe, published by Ballantine Books, an imprint of Random House, and now available in paperback, is not exactly befuddled, and anyway, he's only a little bit you.
Why are you talking like that?
Like what? I was just thinking about how Christmas is right around the corner, but no matter how you choose to celebrate the holidays, books in general make great gifts.
Like that? Like you're selling things to an audience. Are you on Ellen right now?
Dad, I wouldn't be calling you from the set of Ellen.
Oh, I'm fancy. I live in Hollywood where people aren't allowed to call their fathers from the set of the Ellen show.
Dad, please. Why did we live on the houseboat again?
Well, I was working for that congressman, and the hours were long, and I'd drop you off in the morning and not see you until after 6 p.m., and I felt bad about that. I wasn't sure I was on the right career path anyway. Also, I was sort of seeing this girl. You remember the one who owned the horse. Well, she lived there on and off, and I thought I'd go there too and write. And
I'm going to interrupt my father here. Well, actually, he's still talking, so shh, don't tell him. But I have to explain to you that as a kid, I thought my father never dated anyone at all until he met and married my stepmother. It wasn't until years later that I figured out the young ladies who sometimes came around may have been a wee bit more than the cat sitter, that nice woman I play tennis with, and the girl who owned the horse. And I don't blame them. I mean, who wouldn't want a cat sit for this guy? See photo number 4, my dad holding me wearing a thick 70s belt. By the way, can we talk about the unnecessary thickness of children's belts of the 1970s? I mean, look at the... Oops, my dad's still on the phone.
And anyway, she knew these people at the marina in St. Thomas.
So did we, like, sail around the island and stuff?
Oh, no. The engine didn't work on the boat.
The engine didn't... We lived on a giant floating bathtub that went nowhere?
It was a strange place, I'll admit, that marina, but friendly, very bohemian. Everybody there was sort of dropping out from society, which we were too, in a way, for weeks after we'd left D.C. I'm pretty sure my mother still thought I worked on Capitol Hill. But I got to spend more time with you, which was the goal. It was beautiful there. We drove around a lot, went to the beach. It probably seems strange to you now, but it was a 1970s thing to do, I guess. And we had fun.
You did a lot for me, Dad. I love you.
I love you too, kid. Who is this again?
When I was about 5 years old, we moved to Southampton, New York, presumably to live in a house you couldn't dive off of, and I started kindergarten. One day during my first few weeks of school, the teacher left the room. Leaving youngsters alone with open jars of paste was also very 1970s. And when she came back, she found me reading a book to the class. At first, she thought maybe I'd memorized it from having it read to me at home, but after I wowed them with the cold read of another one, take that, green eggs and ham, they had to admit I could actually read. My father had read to me every night for as long as I could remember, and at some point, I guess, I just sort of got it. But this confused the teacher and the school because I'd unintentionally undermined their entire plan for the year. If I wasn't in kindergarten to be taught to read, could they really justify sharing and finger painting as a comprehensive year-long curriculum? If not, what were they supposed to do with me? I was sent to the office of a groovy guy named Mike. I don't know what Mike's actual job at the school was, but I remember sitting in his office, drawing pictures of my feelings or whatever, the 70s, while he leaned back in his chair with his feet up on the desk, which is how I knew he was groovy in the first place. This went on for days. Mike kept asking me if I was bored in kindergarten. Not really, Mike. Have you seen the awesome books they have in there? And that's about all I remember. But by the end of the week, I had apparently convinced Mike that making chains out of construction paper for an entire year would be beneath me intellectually, and he sent me on to first grade. During my first day in the new class, the teacher held a mock election and asked each student to come up and mark on the blackboard whom they'd vote for in the upcoming presidential election, McGovern or Nixon, the 70s. McGovern won by a landslide, not in real life, but weirdly, in this class. And I was one of very few kids who voted for Nixon. This gave me an uneasy feeling, even though I had no idea who either of the candidates was or even what the word candidate meant. I knew that in not being part of the majority, I'd somehow made the wrong choice. Also, how could the entire room not vote for a guy named Nixon? Because seriously, how cool was it to have the letter X in your name? That this distinguishing feature didn't similarly blow everyone else's mind the way it did mine was my first indication that I was in over my head. Initially, skipping a grade seemed like an accomplishment of some sort, but what I remember most was how totally baffled and uncomfortable I felt, especially for the first few weeks. I'd never really had trouble fitting in before, and now, instead of feeling special or gifted, I just felt awkward and out of place. Suddenly, this thing that had made me stand out and had impressed some people now made me feel like an oddball. But skipping a grade also gave me the sense throughout my entire childhood that I'd been given an extra year. It floated around in my head like a lucky coin, something I wanted to hold on to as long as I could until the day I really needed to use it. I don't know why exactly, but somehow I got the idea that life was just a massive competition to get to some sort of finish line, like one long extended season of The Amazing Race. In skipping a grade, I'd been given the ultimate fast forward. This would ensure I'd be able to skip over whatever the life equivalent is of the Chamozal race in New Zealand, beating out even the most awesome teams like the Twinnies or the Afghanimals. then arrive first and be met by an adorable gnome, an oversized cardboard check for $1 million from Phil, and a trip from Travelocity. There were a few years in there where I mostly forgot about the whole skipping a grade thing. In elementary and middle school, I spent time riding horses every weekend, sometimes working in a barn after school, and having birthday slumber parties during which we'd sneak out in the middle of the night to go pajama streaking. We're running around the block in our pajamas. The excitement! I also enjoyed such sophisticated pastimes as toilet papering people's houses. This wasn't necessarily a bad thing in my group of friends. In fact, it was a good sign if people cared enough to teepee your house. I remember praying I'd be teepeed more. Acting out elaborate soap operas involving my troll dolls, making horse blankets for my 37 Briar horses, and recording Judy Garland movies off the television with my red plastic Radio Shack tape recorder. I'd stay up late, listening to my cassette tapes over and over, which is why I'm happy to announce I can still perform the trolley song for you right now. With my high starch collar and my high top shoes and my hair piled high up on my... Oh, what's that? Oh, okay. You're probably right. Let's do it later. Anyway, my dad met my stepmother around this time, and they got married. And we moved farther out into the suburbs of Virginia, partly so I'd be closer to the barn where I rode, which was ironic, since it wouldn't be long before I'd replace all the time I'd been spending there with all the time I'd spend doing school plays. Skipping a grade came up again during my sophomore year of high school, when everyone but me started getting their driver's license. I wanted off the school bus badly, and not being able to drive until later than everyone else seemed an unfair penalty for being able to read a little bit before them. The drinking age in Virginia was 21, but just over the bridge in D.C. it was only 18, and we heard that fake IDs worked there with surprising regularity. Our desire to get into the bars in Georgetown was due mainly to a wish to be able to dance for hours with the music turned up to volumes that weren't allowed in our suburban basements. This was during a time in high school when dancing was in fashion. There came a day when dancing suddenly went away, when it simply wasn't cool anymore. But during that time, it was mysteriously deemed okay, and I remember all of us happily jumping around like freaks for any reason at all. Michael Jackson moonwalked on TV, and no one had seen or heard anything like him. With the top of her convertible VW Rabbit down, Virginia Rowan and I yelled along to Wham! And Morrissey and a new singer named Madonna. Bruce Springsteen was everything then. My friend Catherine Donnelly would regularly get up on a table and sing every word of Born to Run using a broom handle as her microphone. Musically, it was a great time to be a teenager. I wasn't interested in drinking at the time, but some of the other girls were, and everyone was petrified of getting pulled over. So that's how I, at 15 and without a license, was chosen to be the regular designated driver of Joyce Antonio's father's Mercedes. This made perfect sense to me as fair payment for having to suffer through the injustice of being a year younger than everyone else. My friends who wanted to drink were covered. Everybody won! What a terrible idea this was. Literally the worst example of learning by doing ever. But I remember all of us thinking it was a really wise and grown-up choice and feeling very proud of ourselves for figuring out this genius way to solve our need to dance while drinking illegally problem. Because really, aren't laws actually just pesky suggestions? Who needs them? 15-year-olds know everything. The good news was that we'd taken the Don't Drink and Drive campaign seriously. The bad news was that the Don't Get on the Road If You Aren't a Licensed Driver campaign just didn't have as catchy a slogan. In fact, driving without a license was such a dumb idea, I doubt it had even occurred to anyone to start an ad campaign about how dumb it was. Miraculously, we all lived. And eventually, I got my license. During the driving part of the test, I worried that my ability to parallel park on the first try would raise eyebrows, and the instructor would turn to me and say, "I have a suspicion you know how to do this because of all the time you spent sneaking into Winston's with a fake ID so you could dance all night to PYT." Lucky for me, he didn't. Throughout all of this, my free year was still on my mind, and I was so intent on saving it for the right time that I missed an opportunity where it actually might have been helpful. I spent my freshman year in the undergraduate acting program at NYU's Tisch School of the Arts. It is and was a wonderful program, and I had some great teachers, but at just 17 years old, I felt lost and doing things like sitting in a chair for hours, attempting to summon feelings of cold and hot, wasn't what I envisioned college to be. I visited friends at other more academic programs, and I worried I was missing out. So at the end of the year, I transferred to Barnard College to be an English major. Not surprisingly, my temperatures class, among others, didn't have much value at my new school, and almost none of my credits transferred. This would have been a wonderful time to start over as a freshman, but I wasn't ready to let go of my lucky penny just yet. So in order to graduate on time, I had to take a full academic load every semester. To that, I added plays and musicals and the a cappella group The Metrotones, which toured other colleges most weekends. I was completely overwhelmed and behind on my studies for 3 years straight. Barnard College has been very good to me, and I love going back to speak there or just to visit, but I'm sure they've rightly buried my transcript somewhere far below the one train at 116th Street and Broadway. The year after I graduated from college ended up being the moment when I finally plunked my lucky penny down on the table. Most people would just call this the year after I graduated from college, but to me, it became the withdrawal on the time I'd put in the bank in my head. My best friends from school all either had gone abroad, had gotten jobs somewhere besides New York, or had a year of school left. So without any of my buddies to share a place with, I lived in a tiny room in an apartment that faced an air shaft. Somehow, given my pretty limited and lackluster wardrobe, I was hired at a clothing store where I worked during the day. At night, I got a job as a cocktail waitress. My days usually started before 8 a.m., and I'd get home after 2 a.m., dead on my feet, but facing the same hours the next day. Even so, I didn't earn enough money to have much to live on after I paid my rent. Also, I realized that while I'd spent almost my entire time in school and in the summers being involved in some sort of performing arts, I was now living a life without any of them. Even when I was broke back in college, I was acting or singing in a million productions and could always find a way to see plays and musicals too, volunteer as an usher maybe, or get discounted tickets through the student store. Now, though, I had neither the time nor the money to see anything, let alone be in anything. Worried I'd get rusty, I had to resort to standing in the center of my living room slash kitchen slash bedroom, facing the air shaft, at 3 a.m, practicing scales. Which reminds me, I went to lose a jolly hour on the trolley and lost my heart. Really? You still don't want to hear it? Well, okay. Oh, you're worried about the neighbors in my New York apartment building back then. I never met them, but from what I remember, the people upstairs sounded like they were running a cat hotel while training for Riverdance. But okay, let's wait. The months ticked by, and I became more and more worried. It was one thing to feel the extra year slipping away, but something worse had begun to occur to me. What if 1 year turned into two, and two turned into poor Aunt Melba can't come for Christmas this year, Billy. She's working a double shift again. I'm not sure how my name got changed to Melba in this negative fantasy, but the way things were heading then, anything could happen. I felt trapped, and I felt dumb. I obviously hadn't used my lucky penny at the right time, and now I had no edge, nothing that separated me from any other struggling sap in the city. What was I going to do? Drop everything and move to an engineless houseboat in a harbor in St. Thomas? This wasn't Go Find Yourself 1972 anymore. It was 1989, and the belts were way thinner. At a loss, I signed up to participate in what was called the ERTAs, a yearly audition held in New York by a consortium of graduate programs in the arts. Since these schools were located all over the country, they sent representatives to New York to recruit actors once a year. As my potential new life plan, this made no sense. I was still heavily in debt from undergrad, so paying for graduate school wasn't an option at all. Plus, moving anywhere else seemed counterintuitive. I dreamed my whole life of making it in New York City, and I'd made it. Well, I resided there, at least. Now I was going to, what, move to Denver? It seemed I was getting further away from my dream, not closer to it. But there was only a month left on my apartment lease, and I had to make some decisions. Would I stay, or would I go? To be at the audition, I had to take time off from work I couldn't afford. I was asked to prepare a classical monologue, a contemporary monologue, and a song. I spent any free hours I had at the Lincoln Center Performing Arts Library, listening to cast albums and reading plays. I had no coach or teacher or really anyone to try my material out on. In the end, I blindly chose an odd assortment. Linda from Savage in Limbo by John Patrick Shanley, Rosalind from As You Like It, and Somewhere That's Green from Little Shop of Horrors. I had nowhere to rehearse, no time to prepare. I'd go to sleep after 12 hours on my feet, just reciting the lines in my head. The audition was held in a slightly spooky old theater in Times Square. I'd hardly even done the pieces out loud before. The stage was massive. I'd never performed in a space so huge. And my voice sounded thin. The audience was unresponsive. But somehow, I got in. I was actually accepted to a few places, but at Southern Methodist University, I was offered something I didn't even know existed, a full scholarship to their Meadows School for the Arts. I mean, who in their right mind would offer to pay for actors to become actors? Bob Hope, that's who. There's a whole theater there named after him, and in general, it's a very wealthy school. But I'd never dreamed of such a miraculous thing. I felt relieved to have a new path and vindicated to still be on track. I wasn't ahead, but at least I was normal, going to graduate school at normal people times. Except that when I got there, I realized that there was no normal. There were students from all over the place, all of them different ages and at various stages of their lives and careers. This was shocking to me. Didn't they know the clock was ticking? Weren't they worried about getting the first tuk-tuk in Bangkok? Apparently, they were not. I also discovered that being away from New York at a more traditionally collegiate school had its merits and its comforts. I lived in a sprawling apartment complex with new wall-to-wall carpeting and a pool. I got to focus on being a performer without having to worry about my academics or the basics of surviving in the city, something I didn't have that first year at NYU. I had an incredible acting teacher, Cecil O'Neill. I made great friends. We laughed a lot, loved each other, and tortured each other, as only a close-knit company of actors knows how to do. There was a guy in the class ahead of us who nicknamed everyone's heads, for example, according to what they reminded him of. Members of our class were named Pumpkinhead, Pencil Eraser Head, and Punched In Football Head, among others. I was dubbed Hairhead. I can't imagine why. See photo number 5, me with big hair. I still find that in general, having a plan is, well, a good plan. But when my carefully laid plan laughed at me, rather than clutch at it too tightly, I just made a new one, even if it was one that didn't immediately make sense. In blindly trying a different path, I accidentally found one that worked better. So don't let your plan have the last laugh, but laugh last when your plan laughs. And when your plan has the last laugh, laugh back laughing. People always ask me how I got to be an actor. The good news and the bad news is there is no one way. That I thought I had some sort of leg up on life or my career by bartering my perceived time chip was an illusion. In life, of course, there is no fast forward. Fast forward doesn't even always work on The Amazing Race. Half the time, the team in first place makes it onto the earliest flight to a new city, thinking they're ahead, and arrives at the next destination only to find it doesn't open for 2 more hours. Then the other teams catch up, evening the playing field once more. On The Amazing Race, this might mean you lose $1 million. But in life, maybe it's actually fine? Because who wants to fast forward anyway? You might miss some of the good parts. I'd rather keep pushing the rewind button on my red Radio Shack tape recorder and be that geek who knows the lyrics to the songs from every Judy Garland musical ever. Oh, really? Now's a good time? Oh, good. Here goes. Clang, clang, clang went the trolley. Sweat equity. For some reason, I had very old-timey ideas about what show business was like when I was first starting out. Maybe it was all those afternoons I spent watching the 4:30 movie when I was supposed to be doing my homework. Sorry, Dad. Back then, there weren't many ways to learn about what the life of a working actor was actually like, or even get a glimpse into how to get started. Pre-American Idol, the closest thing we had to a show business competition was Star Search, but the acting portion was oddly stiff and theatrical, and never seemed very authentic. The world of entertainment-related periodicals was different then, too. There weren't 15 gossip publications like there are today, all of them competing to be the first to tell you where J-Lo had dinner last night, or to reveal the name of Kate Hudson's new Bichon Frise. The National Enquirer spent some time on the secret world of celebrities, but focused equally on alien babies and Loch Ness monster sightings. There was no Real Housewives of anywhere, and no Twitter or Instagram or Snapchat, where people could constantly update you on their every move. People, even famous people, had not yet begun to focus on their brands, and there was really only one daily show about Hollywood, Entertainment Tonight, which was pretty fluffy back then and fairly tame. Magazines were not yet going after every detail of what went on behind the scenes. No one was asking the important questions of today, like, whose cellulite is this? The 4:30 movie featured mostly old films and was categorized around a weekly theme. Elvis Week, Westerns Week, Horror Week, etc. That's where I fell in love with movie musicals starring Gene Kelly and Judy Garland. That's where I decided Katharine Hepburn was my favorite actress of all time. That's where I learned that an actor's highest calling was the theater, and the ultimate goal for a true thespian was Broadway, emphasis on the way. I was inspired by the black-and-white movies of the 1930s and 1940s, like Stage Door, in which young hopefuls lived together in a sorority-type house, sleeping with their hair in old-fashioned curlers that looked more like rags, practicing dance steps in their tiny galley kitchen while wearing silk tap pants and dreaming of Broadway. I loved their vivid vernacular and tried to incorporate it into my life. "Say, fella, this gal's got sore gams," I was in the habit of saying. "My dogs are barking. Got a dime for a cup of Joe?" This being the mid-80s, no one had any idea what I was talking about. I was determined to make it to Broadway, and that meant I somehow had to become a member of Actors Equity, the theatrical union. The union conundrum. You can't get a union card without getting a union job, and you can't get a union job unless you're in the union. My plan, although the path was long, was to earn enough hours as an equity apprentice to become eligible, which could take years. The only faster way would be to somehow get cast in an equity role. Apparently, this happened once in a while when a part called for something unique that none of the members of the equity company were able to do. As a young actor, I remember focusing obsessively on the special skills section of my resume, peppering it with abilities, even ones I only sort of had, in case one of them might lead to my big break. Included on my resume at the time were skills such as driving, not a given in New York City, roller skating, the musical Starlight Express was big at the time, dialects, although this claim was vague and pretty much untrue, I felt it made me seem sophisticated and Shakespearean, and Rhonda Weiss impressions. Rhonda Weiss was one of my favorite characters from Gilda Radner's Live at Carnegie Hall show, a VHS tape I watched obsessively. Why I thought anyone would be more impressed by my Rhonda Weiss than by Gilda Radner's is still an embarrassing mystery to me today. But back then, especially when coupled with dialects and driving, I thought it made me seem quirky and well-rounded. Probably despite these skills rather than because of them, I landed a spot in the Equity Apprentice program at the Barn Theater in Augusta, Michigan. The Barn was, and is, a well-respected summer theater that had a resident equity company and even occasionally drew some Broadway stars. In the lobby of the theater hung framed headshots of Barneys of note, actors who'd once been apprentices here, just like I was, and had gone on to bigger things. I didn't recognize any of their faces, but I was still impressed. It was beyond my wildest hope that my headshot would one day hang in this lobby too, prompting scores of theatergoers to remark, "Who?" I could only dream of such obscurity. On the first day at the Barn, all the equity apprentices auditioned for the directors and members of the equity company to get their specific casting for the summer. The core equity company consisted of experienced actors, most from New York, who'd been hired for the whole summer. Many of them had worked at the theater before, and they all knew each other. They asked me a few questions, then chose a piece for me to sight read, a Gershwin number from the musical Crazy for You. I didn't know the song, but the whole point was to see how well we could perform with limited preparation. The rehearsal period for each show was only 2 weeks, so it was important to show them how quickly we could learn music and dance steps. I was nervous, but not too worried, since in general, I could sight read pretty well. Or so I thought. Even though I was only expected to read off sheet music on the stand in front of me, I wanted to really perform the song to prove I was not only a speedy learner and a good singer, but a good actress too. My casting for the entire season depended on what I did in this audition. The pianist played through a few bars and hummed the melody for me until I felt ready to try the song alone. Then I took a deep breath and started to sing. Zoom, 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 the world is in a mess. With politics and taxes and people grinding axes, there's no happiness. Looking out at the sea of faces in the audience, I could tell right away that I was doing well. I felt relaxed and my voice sounded strong. People were smiling and tapping their toes to the beat. Zoom, 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 rhythm lead your ace. The future doesn't fret me if I can only get me someone to slap that bass. I saw one of the equity actors in the audience exchange a look with the music director. She clapped her hand over her mouth like she was stifling a laugh. He giggled back at her and slapped his knee, and I thought, wow, are they impressed or what? It's almost as if they've never seen an apprentice perform this well on their first day. I wondered briefly if I had a chance at getting my equity card in my first summer. I'd been told that never happened, but what if? They'd talk about it for years to come. Not only would my headshot be displayed in the lobby, but maybe they'd need a plaque touting my incredible accomplishment as well. Apprentice for a day, then straight to Broadway, it would say. A wave of extra confidence washed over me, hurtling me toward the chorus. Everyone in the audience was laughing now, and I thought, well, that's sort of weird, but they aren't stopping me, and they all look pretty pleased. The problem was that they looked almost too pleased. I hadn't really seen Slap That Bass as much of a comedic song, but maybe I was wrong. So I decided to go with their response and sort of shimmied my shoulders, adding even more personality and pizzazz. There was no doubting it now. Everyone was now becoming almost hysterical. One of the actresses was wiping tears away. She was laughing so hard. I'm just naturally funny, I guess, I thought. I never realized it to this degree before. This is for sure the day I'll be discovered. Never mind my promotion to the equity company. Maybe I won't even last the summer here. What if they send me directly to Broadway? I wondered if I'd have to drop out of Barnard, and if not, how I would manage both my schoolwork and my full-time stardom. Flushed with the excitement of my newfound destiny, I beamed back at them all and headed into my big finish. In which case, if you want a bobble, slap that bass, slap away your trouble, learn to zoom, 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 slap that bass. Arms outstretched, I held the last note as long as I could. The entire room applauded, I bowed, and then they all dissolved into giggles. For a while, they were laughing so hard that no one could speak. Finally, the music director waved his arm over his head, signaling everyone to be quiet. Lauren, he said kindly, you have a good voice. A good voice? Didn't he mean a spectacular, transcendent, unique, miracle voice from Heavenland? A very good voice, he said, and paused. I could tell he was struggling to keep a straight face. But I don't think Ira Gershwin wrote this song about a fish. For a moment, I felt surrounded by fog, or like I'd just been woken up from a deep sleep. What was he talking about? What about a fish? Why would he... And then it hit me. In my haste to show how quickly I could learn the song, I hadn't really stopped to consider what the song was about, which was someone joyously playing the bass fiddle. I mean, I sort of knew that, but in my nervousness, I didn't pronounce bass like the instrument, like face or place or even ace, a word that was actually in the song. I pronounced it like pass, grass, or ass, which was also what I now felt like. Fueled by adrenaline and dreams of my equity card, I'd turned a song about playing an instrument into a song about abusing a fish. Over and over, I'd just gleefully sung about hitting the poor fishy upside the head. I'd given slapping a bass a whole new meaning. No wonder they were laughing so hard. In my mind's eye, I removed my framed headshot from the theater lobby. My plaque faded into the wings. My equity card evaporated in the glare of the footlights. But eventually I recovered and managed to get into the summer stock routine. The apprentices worked very, very hard. In addition to rehearsing during the afternoon, our duties included anything and everything it took to keep the theater going, including costume sewing, set building, and floor mopping. Mornings were spent doing chores like cleaning the bathrooms and painting the fence that surrounded the property. I lucked out and for a few weeks got a coveted job working in the box office, taking ticket orders over the phone. The box office was luxurious compared to the outdoor activities we performed in the 100-degree heat. It had both air conditioning and a constant influx of baked goods from the theater-loving locals. The baked goods were supposed to be sent directly to the Equity actors, but most never made it past whoever was manning the phones. Every day, I'd have stolen cakes and cookies for breakfast, a Chinese chicken salad from McDonald's for lunch. Do they still make this? It was so good. And then came dinner, or what passed for dinner on an apprentice's non-existent salary, a combination of food and beverage that I loved more than I've loved some meals I've had at restaurants with Michelin stars. I'll tell you what it was in a second, but I warn you, it appeals only to those with the most discerning palates. After the main stage shows, there was a sort of bar that opened next door to the theater called The Shed, where the apprentices performed cabaret-type songs and skits for any audience members who didn't yet want to call it a night. On the main stage, we were chorus members, bit players at best. But at The Shed show afterward, we were the stars. I personally wowed audiences by accompanying myself on songs with the acoustic guitar I brought from home, my greatness limited only by my dreams and the fact that I knew how to play just three chords. But that's all you need for leaving on a jet plane, my friends. At The Shed, the stars were also the waiters, so the storeroom in the back doubled as our backstage area and locker room. It was a chaotic jumble of costume pieces for our upcoming numbers, bar supplies, and personal stuff. The back room was also where they kept the snackins, an evil mix of delicious seasoned crackers and pretzels that I'm pretty sure the dastardly Gardetto's company invented in an attempt to ruin my career, even though, at the time, I had no career to speak of. We weren't allowed to indulge in the snackins, which were kept in giant garbage bin-sized tubs in the storeroom. Those were only for the paying customers. The theater owners were very strict about this, so I'm here to tell you and any former employers or health inspectors who may be reading this that we 100% did not reach our grubby hands into the giant bins over and over every night until we were sick with salt bloat. How dare you imply such a thing? That summer, I also discovered the first alcoholic drink I actually liked the taste of. A drink that was very hip and happening at the time and is still a sign of intellect and sophistication. I'm talking, of course, about the fuzzy navel. This nutrient-packed, classy combination of snackins and fuzzy navels was my dinner for 2 whole months. Halfway through the summer, an incredible opportunity came up. An equity part was going to be given to one of the apprentices. It was a smallish part, so to bring an equity actor all the way from New York would be too costly. It was cheaper to just give one of the apprentices their card and pay them equity wages for the 2-week run. This was exactly the scenario I'd imagined, precisely the break I'd been hoping for. There was much excitement and discussion among the apprentices about the part, and also about what it required. The play was a farce, a broad comedy about two cheating husbands and the wives they're lying to, and the role was a French maid that one of the husbands is caught having an affair with. When the maid and the husband are discovered in bed, the maid stands up in fright, and as she's facing upstage, babbling in French, the blanket that's been covering her falls, exposing her bare backside to the audience. The rumor was that the director would only be bringing a few girls in to audition, and we wondered nervously whom he'd choose. The next day, a short list was posted, and my name was on it. I was thrilled and flattered. We then learned that the entire audition would consist of being brought into a room and showing our bare butts to the director. I wasn't sure exactly how that would work. Enter walking backward? And I thought it was a little odd that we weren't being asked to read even a small part of the actual scene, but I was still both thrilled and flattered. This was the sort of thing professional actresses were asked to do all the time. My equity card was just a bare butt flash away. The chosen butts became an instant club of sorts. We tried our best to be professional and not act overly excited, but it was clear we were bonded because of our excellent butts, I mean acting ability. We didn't want those of lesser butt to feel left out, but we'd subtly smile at each other in the hallways, pleased at having been singled out for our shapely butts, I mean talent. The phrase, butt buddies, had never made so much sense. The day of the audition came. We were asked to disrobe from the waist down in private, and when we were ready, two girls holding a sheet walked out slightly in front of us. We walked up behind them and turned around, The girls dropped the sheet for a brief moment for the director, then they put it back up, and we all walked out together. During the entrance and exit, the director made innocuous small talk. His wife was sitting beside him, there to ensure we were comfortable. Everyone was very respectful. The whole thing was over so quickly, I barely had time to register any feelings about it at all. I walked out smiling, waved to the rest of my BBs, who were waiting to go in, got dressed, and went to a secluded place behind the theater where I burst into tears. There was nothing wrong with the way anyone conducted themselves that day. The audition process was thoughtfully executed. The play was silly and full of sexual innuendo, and nudity was called for in the script. I just didn't like it. The audition made me feel vulnerable and just plain bad about myself. On top of that, I was embarrassed not to have thought the whole thing through more thoroughly. I wanted my equity card so desperately, I hadn't stopped to ask myself what I was comfortable doing in order to get it. In art, the painter presents his canvas. In acting, the canvas is you. Over the years, I've learned to have a sort of distance from myself in certain situations. I've regularly stripped down to nothing in front of a stranger in order to have a fitting, for example. As actors, we are poked and prodded by other artists whose contributions are vital to presenting the canvas at its best. Hair, makeup, lighting, scenery. The canvas is given lines to say, someone else's clothes to wear. In acting, you have to have an objectivity that enables you to, at times, turn yourself over to someone else and let them do the painting. But this was my first experience paying more attention to the canvas part than the me part, and I realized both sides needed to line up. I'd thought it was mature and professional to do anything asked of me to get the job. I learned a little too late that day that maybe it was more complex than that. The girl who got the part was an apprentice in her second or third year, a great comedian with a great figure. She had no problem being semi-naked in rehearsals and seemed to really enjoy doing the show every night. There's a lid for every pot, they say, and there's definitely an actor for every role and then some. The truth was, even if I'd gotten it, that part just wasn't a good fit. The me of today often reads scripts I don't connect with, and I've learned not to worry about it too much. If a story doesn't resonate with me, even if it's a really good one, even if it's one I wish I could be part of, I just have to accept that I probably wouldn't be as compelling as someone else could be in the role, and it's become fairly easy to let them go. One of my incredible acting teachers, Wynne Hanman, always talked about how important it was to have a feel for the material. He dismissed the idea that every actor should be able to tackle every part. Charlie Chaplin did just one thing, he'd say. He just did it better than everyone else. Later on, I'd learn not to feel too bad when I realized a part wasn't right for me. But at that young age, with only high school and college plays on my resume, I didn't think I had any right to be choosy or to have much of an opinion about what I wanted to do. At the time, I had only the vaguest hint that my instincts might be worth respecting. It would take many more years to learn how best to respond to those instincts. But when, during the course of my early career, I was asked a few more times about nudity, the answer was always a fairly easy no. Nothing wrong with it, a vital part of some kinds of storytelling, just not for me. In my second summer at the Barn, I was given an equity role without even having to audition for it. I was chosen. This was a real honor and a very big deal among the other apprentices, and it happened so much earlier than I thought it would. My headshot plaque dreams returned. The character was named Marjorie Baverstock, and the play was called The Musical Comedy Murders of 1940. The 1940s! The decade all my after-school TV viewing had been preparing me for! It was meant to be! My character was an older aristocrat in her early 50s, whom a bunch of young theater hopefuls are trying to impress so she'll give them money to put on a show. The fact that I was 10 years younger than the people playing the young hopefuls was no problem. This was the theater, and I was an actrice, up for any challenge. I'd simply bring my years of high school experience putting on old age makeup to bear, because everyone agrees that drawing all over your face with a white grease paint pencil to simulate wrinkles looks convincing as hell. My character sits in a chair near the end of Act One, while the young hopefuls keep trying to impress her with increasingly frantic and ambitious musical numbers. What they don't know, but the audience sees, is that during one of their numbers, Marjorie is stabbed through the back of the chair. by a mysterious villain. So while the performers think Marjorie isn't responding to their audition because she's not impressed, in reality, she's not responding because she is not alive. The crowd dissolves into giggles, supposedly. The trick of this entire gag is that Marjorie, although dead, keeps her eyes open. That's why the audition kids go on singing and dancing for so long. Hilarious! See photo number 6. Me as Marjorie Baverstock. There was only one problem. Well, actually, there were at least 3 problems. That I was playing 35 years older than I was, that I'd apparently learned nothing from the previous summer's Snackens diet, and that, too late in the rehearsal process, I discovered that one of my special skills was not an ability to keep my eyes open for as long as was required. I don't know how the person in the original cast did it. After 20 seconds, my eyes started to water, and after about 45 seconds, no matter how hard I tried not to, I had to blink. I think we can all agree that in general, dead people don't blink very much. The audience was supposed to laugh at the enthusiasm of the young hopefuls frenzied auditioning, but on opening night, the biggest laughs came from my supposedly dead Marjorie having dry contact lenses. In the first professional review I ever received, the Kalamazoo Gazette said that while my character died at the end of the first act, they wished, for my sake, that I'd died sooner. More tears behind the theater. Look at it this way, the director said later. Your reviews can only get better from here. But I'd never know because I haven't read a review of myself since that day. I've also never Googled myself. What good can come of it? I've learned over the years that when someone says something really nice about you, in print or otherwise, it has a way of reaching you. Friends and agents can't wait to tell you when someone says something positive. When the papers say something not so nice, your friends and agents get a shifty, faraway look or say nothing, and that tells me everything. What more details would I possibly need? I wish she died sooner. In high school, my acting teacher, Brian Nelson, told us there were only 2 important pieces of feedback in the theater. If someone told you they liked what you did, or if they said they couldn't hear you well enough. As an actor, speak up is a pretty objectively helpful piece of criticism. The rest is just one person's opinion. Though the one thing I'd add is pronounce words correctly and try to know the difference between a stringed instrument and a fish. Years later, I would finally make it to Broadway, after all, and it was just as thrilling and exhilarating as I'd imagined, quite literally a dream come true. But my name was on the poster, and I discovered there was a lot of pressure and responsibility that came with that. And even though I was honored to play Miss Adelaide in the revival of Guys and Dolls and loved being a member of that incredible company, a part of me also longed for simpler days, back when it was plenty thrilling to just be in the chorus of Oklahoma and Brigadoon, when the furthest my imagination could stretch, the biggest success I dared wish for, the closest I thought I'd ever get to the dream of becoming like my idols from the 4:30 movie, was to have my picture hanging in the lobby of a small theater in Augusta, Michigan. See photo number 7, my old, old headshot. You can't be vegan just for Ellen. I worry about this chapter because I'm pretty sure it's the only one I'll get asked about when I'm promoting this book on the Today Show. Hi, Matt! No matter what else public figures accomplish, we just seem to want to know what they eat for breakfast and what their beauty routine is. Next up, Ruth Bader Ginsburg on being a Supreme Court justice and how she successfully tackles a bad hair day. You at home can be the judge. In our next segment, President Hillary Clinton, it's only March as I write this, so I'm just guessing, shares her State of the Union highlights and her red carpet slim-down secrets. I wish we could all stop worrying about it so much, but that's probably unrealistic. So rather than tell you not to worry, I'm going to tell you some of the top secret Hollywood secrets I've learned and save you a ton of money instead. Here's one. Diet books are worthless. Don't spend one more penny on them. Not one more. I'm serious. They all tell you a version of the exact same thing. Eat less, work out more. Now, I'm not a doctor, and I'll probably never play one on TV, because can you imagine? During the original series, Gilmore Girls' table reads were held in the same conference room where the crime procedural Cold Case had theirs. And sometimes I'd pick up one of those scripts and try to read the lines out loud with a straight face, not making fun of them, but really trying to sound convincing. Anyone who happened to be in the room would inevitably fall down on the floor, holding their stomach and laughing. The lines weren't bad. I was. The problem is, I'm physically incapable of sounding at all convincing as a police-type person or a private investigator. In fact, I'm not even sure that the job of the character on Cold Case was either of those things, because while all those jobs are, of course, distinct and challenging and incredibly impressive in real life, on TV, I find they all blend together, and all I hear is, I'm extremely sincere and competent. As an actor person, as well as a person person, I don't think I naturally exude competence. I exude more of an, I'm kind of winging it here, but isn't this fun type of vibe, which is probably not what you'd want coming from the person driving your ambulance or a doctor or Dexter. Speaking of fake doctors, my sister worked for a literary agent for a while, which is how I learned the interesting fact that early drafts of the scripts for doctor-type shows don't have all the technical medical jargon in them yet. While writers of a medical show probably have some sort of general doctorish knowledge, there are experts whose specialty it is to make sure the lines are accurate. The writer and the accuracy person don't necessarily work together every day, so an early draft of a script might have the major story beats and the personal, juicy character stuff that the writer of the script is in charge of, but instead of medical jargon, there'll be placeholder words. In the case of the medical show my sister told me about, the words, aptly, were medical, as in, yes, Dr. Jones, I'd love to meet you in the supply closet, but first I have to administer 40 cc's of medical to my patient's medical, or he may go into medical, then we'll really be in trouble. Medical immediately became a sort of yada 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 for my sister Shade and me. Its origin was as a placeholder for what's to come, but it quickly became an even more general placeholder for us. It can mean anything from, you know what I'm talking about, to, ugh, why is this purse so expensive? If my sister was at work and didn't have enough time to tell me about a date she'd gone on, she'd say, he talked about himself the whole night, his shoes were weird, medical, and I'd know exactly what she meant. So I'm not even a good fake doctor. I'm more comfortable saying medical than spewing any actual technical jargon, and therefore the extent of my health advice is this. Just don't eat a lot of crap. Take walks. Thank you for buying this book, the end. But Lauren, you live in Hollywood, where the most incredibly attractive, healthy-looking people are. Can't you give us more insight than that? Okay, fine. Here are some more of the top-secret Hollywood secrets I've learned from years of talking to the best nutritionists, personal trainers, Eastern and Western medicine practitioners, and famous skinny people. Every bit of advice below was actually given to me by a fancy person or someone who knows a fancy person and the methods they use to stay fancy. Over the years, I've been told that meat is an important protein. Meat is bad for you. The best way to lose weight is to eat a high-protein diet. The best way to lose weight is to eat a vegan diet. Juicing is good for you. Juice cleanses are pointless. Someone with my blood type should eat only lamb, mutton, turkey, and rabbit, and avoid chicken, beef, ham, and pork. Bacon is okay. Bacon is bad for you. Consuming fat helps you lose weight. All fats should be avoided or used minimally. Yogurt helps your digestion. Yogurt has no impact on your digestion. Calcium from dairy is good for you. Dairy is bad for you. Gluten is no problem for people without celiac disease. Everyone should be gluten-free. Kale is a superfood. Too much kale can actually result in a thyroid condition causing you to gain weight. And using non-natural toothpaste can cause bloating of up to 5 pounds. Just eating fruits and vegetables? Sure, that sounds like a good plan. As long as you aren't sensitive to nightshades, eggplant, tomatoes, peppers, like some people are, you could probably be fine if you ate nothing but spinach all day, unless it's the spinach that was part of the recent salmonella recall. Fruits are okay, but some fruits, like bananas, are so high in natural sugar, you might as well eat a piece of cake. What's that? You're still eating regular processed sugar, the kind that's actually in cake? How are you still standing? Should I call an ambulance? If indeed you do end up at the hospital, just remember you shouldn't eat grapefruit before taking medications because it can block their effectiveness. So enjoy your new diet of berries and water, people. Unless you're allergic to strawberries, that is, as many people are. And don't forget to also be very, very, very worried about GMOs. And don't drink just any water either. Tap water is obviously poison, but beware the BPAs in your bottled water too. Also try to get the type of bottled water that addresses your imbalanced pH levels, because while you may not know it yet, most of us are too acidic and not alkaline enough. Well, there you have it. Makes sense. After all, I've given you the secret to everything. It's obvious what you should do now. Could it be any clearer? You're welcome. What's that? Huh? My editor, Jennifer E. Smith, has just informed me that my book is late. Wait, no, that can't be, because you're listening to it. I got confused, since that's what she's calling me about 99% of the time. Oh, it